Right, we are 1 minute into 10 a.m. Very excited for the session. Welcome everyone that has just joined us. It is Thursday, the 20th of February. Jeez, time is flying. I am still in Gauteng. We have had some rainy weathers. Feeling good, feeling calm, collected. We do hope that you are all well and that you're all safe. This rainfall has come with some tragedies and difficulties for some people around these regions, but we do hope that all of you are well. As I've mentioned earlier, please do share in the chat where you are joining us from and how you're feeling today. We will get started in about 2 minutes. I think we should just give a couple of more people a chance to still join, but otherwise, welcome, welcome, welcome. We are back live and direct with yet another Food for Thought welcome open webinar hosted by Oribi's most favorite friend and previous resident coach, Tumi. We welcome you all to this session. I would like to take a moment to at least do something I should have done last week, and that is to give you guys a little bit of an introduction or high level and information around who exactly Tumi is. And she's not just a resident coach that we had at Oribi. She's actually an individual who's passionate about diversity, equity, and inclusion. She's on a mission to support community builders and startups in embedding inclusion and having them kind of have a culture of ensuring that they belong in their work, and demystifying this whole concept of inclusion and belonging through practical guidance and support in implementing these group interventions and meaningful events that she would design. So she's also an executive coach, a training and project manager, an HR consultant, as well as a strategic planner. She runs a studio called Inclusion Studio, of which we can share a little bit about later. We can share the website details of later. And yeah, she's really passionate about inclusion. And as you might have noticed, the topic of today is social solidarity economy. And these core concepts, which she is very passionate about, are one of the I would say the bedstones or the foundational stones of the social solidarity economy, of which you'll be learning quite a lot about today. Diversity, inclusion, and equity also forms part of how we can think about the circular economy. So it really is an honor to have her host these webinars. We believe she is the most appropriate person to be taking on these discussions, aside from her, of course, being a great friend of Oribi. So with that said, folks, I would like to hand it over to Tumi to take on the session further. And yeah, I do hope that you guys find it insightful and that you find it quite thought-provoking, and hopefully it can make you understand a lot better how you integrate into the social solidarity economy. So yeah, cheers guys, enjoy.
Thank you very much, Lucas, for your kind words. Hello, everybody. I am back. For those who were here last week, nice to see you again. For those who are joining for the first time today, hello and welcome. As Lucas very graciously explained, I'm Tumi. I am a friend of Oribi and very excited to be here with all of you today. I am not going to say very much before we get into today's conversation. There is so much to learn. I am going to say, though, that I am very excited for today's guest, who used to be my boss. So this is one of those full circle moments. And I want to say just a few words about Ntux. And I was doing some internet sleuthing earlier, and I found something that Ntux had written about being passionate about self-actualization, economic justice, and social justice in Africa, maintaining that it should be in a sustainable way of living and operating. And that she's also somebody who leans towards innovation and business growth. And so, if we think about all of these things together, number one, I can attest that is absolutely Ntaguana. And number two, I think that means we are in exceptionally amazing hands to have this discussion about social and solidarity economy. So, Ntax, I want to welcome you on stage by asking you one question, which is, what makes you most passionate about food systems?
Okay, thank you for that intro to me. And nice to see you and nice to see everyone. Thanks. I was actually just thinking this week of getting back to LinkedIn and changing up my bio. So I think you've done a little bit of that work for me already. So that's great. So why I'm passionate about food systems? Mainly because I think it's a system that interacts in our day-to-day lives. So it's something that impacts us regardless of which experiences you've had, what background, what place you're at. Food is an important thing and it's a right that should be part of your life. I think I'm also passionate about it because, as you hear, I'm very much driven about justice and economic justice. And I think it's one of the sectors where we can see quite a transformation in terms of justice, in terms of making sure that we pull up and we bring and create more equity within the sector, more inclusion within the sector, and bringing up people who are vulnerable within the sector. And there's room for growth, and it's a system to disrupt. I like to disrupt, so that's what I'm passionate about as well. And I think one of the key things why it's also so important to me and why it's such a high stake for me is because I've genuinely naturally, I suppose I was lucky being raised in a house that's aware around wellness and eating well. I grew up in Lesotho, so subsistence farming and eating well. And I grew up with a grandmother who's also very conscious about what she puts in her body. So it was something that was built into me. And I think for me, as I started to become a mom and now started to have to formalize this for myself during pregnancy and another person that was being birthed, and then obviously as a mom for the building of a household, and I realized like how unsustainable and how inaccessible it is to actually live well and eat well. For me, that I set a panic. It sent a panic that if you have to eat well, live well, be healthy, that you have to be rich, that is nonsense. And that's what for me is drives the passion behind the everyday work. Even when it's hard, I always make that emphasis.
Yeah, I mean, and thank you for also just calling that out, that like we can say as much as we want about eating healthy and being organic and sustainable, and then we must add that you must have a trust fund as well to make it possible. But it's also really interesting to hear as well how it links to sort of your upbringing and how this has been part of who you are for your whole life. So, with that, I want to hand over to you and to say, please help us understand what is the social and solidarity economy and what should we know about it?
Okay, I like the last part. What should we know about it? Because I was like, in 20s, I don't know how much I can teach or educate or transfer. So that's how I've kind of felt through the session about what is important to me. And I think it's important notes to always remember about the social and solidarity economy and why social entrepreneurship is really important. And we can have more time in the Q&A to kind of discuss any further nuances that you want to look at and think about. So let me share my screen. Yeah. Which is the screen to be shared? Yeah. Cool. I know you're seeing the workshop 17 booking now. But I'm just getting to the right slide. I didn't want you to see my 100 tabs. Cool. I called this session. Can you see anything yet?
Not yet.
Still
It's
loading.
loading. It's coming.
Okay. Please let me know when you can see something.
It looks like it's still loading. I wonder if.
Should I try again?
Yeah, I think you should try again. As you do that, for everybody on the call, please remember that you can add questions in the chat at any time. We will have a Q&A after the presentation. So if there's anything that comes up for you, any questions, add them to the chat and we'll come back to them. Also, what's really great is if you see a question in the chat that you have something that you can add to, please, you're welcome to respond to other people's comments in the chat box as well. Part of like social and solidarity economy is also how we interact with each other and build community. And so giving each other comments and input where you have information is 100% a part of that. So don't hesitate to do that.
Okay, so I'm gonna have to do it this way. Apologies, guys. It's not loading my side either. I hope it doesn't ruin the experience in any way, but so that we don't delay and we can get to the conversation. So why I put here, I called it social entrepreneurship and I called it contradiction or solution. And this was really kind of inspired by a conversation that we're having with Carl. It's very different to it's very awkward to be a social entrepreneur because you can sit in civil society circles, you can sit in entrepreneurship circles, you can sit in different, you can sit in the education sector, you can sit in the health sector. So you're often always having a blend, you're a blend of quite a lot of things. And in some spaces you're welcome and not welcome. And in some spaces, you know, you're of course you're welcome. And this particular space was a spaces of radical civil society. And really they were challenging the idea of social entrepreneurship, like just having the word social and entrepreneurship next to each other is an oxymoron. It's not possible. So for me, it's always a question that I think we need to answer, right, in South Africa, because social entrepreneurship has been happening for a long time, but it's not happening in a sustainable way, right? So it's a matter of, is really social entrepreneurship a pathway for South Africa, or is it a contradiction because of the context that we have in South Africa? So it's just to inspire that thought already as we're starting and we are going into it. Another thing I think that brings about it, as well as that social entrepreneurship doesn't necessarily mean, being a social entrepreneur doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be driving inclusion, equity, and diversity, nor are you going to be automatically driving climate action, for example. It requires a radical form, or at least a progressive form of social entrepreneurship to be able to achieve that. And that's where the social and solidarity economy as an umbrella falls on that. So I like to kind of get you into my thinking and what I see as problems, and I suppose being in the sector and also really being having been operating it in quite a while, which make social entrepreneurship necessary. So as you will all know, is that power is concentrated in large corporations and commercial farms, for example. You've just seen, if you was following the Minister of Agriculture's submission in Parliament, the rates of participation, for example, of Black farmers was extremely low. It was sitting at, I don't think there was a sector where there was more than 10% or even 5%. I was quite surprised, like poultry participation was sitting at something like 4%. And of course, that can still be hidden by these kind of apartheid-linked contracting. from the contract management, where the large farms are subcontracting from small scale farmers, so they become invisible in the system. But I think it's quite a big thing to think around. And then also to think that there is a huge concentration across the value chain of where only 20% of players own 80% of the market, whether it's at farming stage, whether it's the marketplace and retail stage, whether it's in distribution and logistics stage. And I think that's a reality that we need to speak about honestly. And it's a reality that has been enabled by our policy decision to go for supermarket dominance, right? Which has its use and not its use. Then the other one is that we know that enough food is being produced. That's what the research is saying in the world to feed us adequately. However, we are seeing food insecurity signals. So, for example, we're seeing the increasing NCDs. This is like your nutrition-related health diseases, for example, like diabetes, and it can sometimes be high blood pressure. Those kind of diseases are increasing because of the poor quality of our diets. And of course, many other reasons. Please always hear that when I'm talking. I can always sound very absolute because I'm passionate, but I recognize there's complexities in everything. We see child stunting and malnutrition in the South African case. We also it means that somewhere, as Tasneem shared with you last week, the system is broken. Then another thing is that obviously with this corporate and industrial value chain. What is good, because we have to be fair, we're balancing scales, right? Is that it has enabled faster distribution of food from globally. For example, it has enabled inter-country faster distribution of food. There are countries that are food deserts where they cannot grow food, where they're able to access food. So we have to recognize that they have and created employment, even though sometimes we question whether that employment is decent, but there's some value that's coming. But this has come at the cost of we have excessive waste, the climate crisis, because it's highly fossil fuel dependent, and we have this lack of access to food. And most of it, for me, it's driven by that you eat with your wallet. So food is a basic right, but you eat with your wallet. So that determines how good your access to the quality, nutritious food is. Then the other thing that is quite interesting that I think we don't focus enough on is that there are millions and millions of meals and food options that are being delivered by the informal food market. So at least 70% of South Africans are buying from these structures. So this is from street vendors, this is from we've got urban gardens that are growing and populating a lot. We've got spaza shops and many other informal markets that are growing up. However, these sort of actors in the food system are facing poor social protection, high policy neglect, and we often do not even consider them as food system innovators. And therefore, for example, there's not enough for them around. If you think about infrastructure, they don't have access to like cold storage, transport, energy, those kind of things. And secondly, the market's access is only restricted to foot traffic, whereas they are operating within an economy where there's ECD centers, there's hospitals, there's clinics, there's a lot of market systems that are opportunities for food. And then again, I will focus again that it's again, women and youth come out as key actors in the system, especially women who act as homemakers. So they're making decisions about food, who are part of mostly of the informal food economy, who are farm workers, who are makers. So even in cultural context, like if you think about family events, weddings, funerals, they're the ones who are kind of contributing unpaid care work in that system. However, they are the same people who are facing low wages and job insecurity because of this precarity of the informal food economy. And then another thing is that young people, I believe, are a force for change that we are overlooking in terms of creating compelling career pathways for them within the agri-food sector and as social innovators. Yeah. So, how could we reimagine the food system with SSE? I think one of the greatest thing is that in 2023, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a definition of the social and solidarity economy, which is great because it signals that there is willingness and there is recognition of the sector, at least at the global level. And I know at the local level, there is a social economy paper, but it's that is being developed in a policy, but no one really knows where it is. It's hit a stumbling block at the moment. However, what social and solidarity means, it's what it's organizers and enterprises that are pushing for social or environmental or economic good. And this is mainly through collective and participatory means. It encompasses a diversity of models. So it can come from, it can be cooperatives, it can be nonprofits, it can be mutual aid, it can self-employment is included in that definition. Grassroots and informal networks are included in that definition, including social enterprises. It's an economy that proposes alternative economic and market structures. So it means that it's challenging capitalist extractive models. And this is mainly by prioritizing people and planet over profits, and also prioritizing collective ownership and also prioritizing social equity and regenerative when possible, because we do have these tensions, for example, in the global south where, people are struggling. So we need to address those needs first, but then how can we intersectionally address those needs by having regenerative food systems and activities happening? And then I won't go again around the collective ownership, but mainly to make sure it's an economy for me that makes sure or can, let me sort of make sure, it can make sure that profits stay in vulnerable communities and that there's shared governance, that profits benefit workers and the local context that they're operating in. And it's a way that it can pull up other marginalized entrepreneurs and suppliers within the system. So this is quite key to then what makes Oribe's definition of what is the key principles of a social enterprise. Like I said, because not every social enterprise is going to be progressive or radical or addressing equity, for example, and climate action. So for us, a social enterprise first has a primary social or environmental mission and can be and it's not just about profit maximization. For us, it's aimed at financial viability. We are not scared of making money and revenue, and we shouldn't be scared of social enterprises of being able to generate revenue, and that revenue is not solely dependent on grants and donations. We believe that also those profits are reinvested back into the mission rather than maximizing the returns to private shareholders. And that's a contentious one, because in a country where we have high poverty, high income, if we're proposing this as a solution, surely their sustainability should be ensured within these models. So that's where I think is a big contention that we're having in the country. And then profits, sorry, I added that again. And then we have democratic governance or decision making. So that's that your social enterprises really is responsive to the community needs. Better if it even includes them as co-owners and co-creators, and better if it includes them as key decision makers in the business and how the business roll out. And then the other one is that it recognizes complexity and systems. So you're not operating alone in a system. It may feel like that, but you prioritize partnership, collaboration, and cooperation more than competition. And then, like I said before, that you see women, youth, and marginalized groups as being actively engaged. So they're not just beneficiaries of your solution, but they are also can be economic participants within your social enterprise. So here, I want to emphasize that I always say, remember that goodwill does not pay the rent. It does not pay the rent. So when we talk about sustainability and financial viability, there's three prongs that you need to always be thinking of in your social enterprise: personal sustainability, not greed; organizational sustainability, not greed; and community sustainability. And you're dancing between those different sustainability in order to create a balance, which is hard when you're also already trying to balance profit and impact, which is often hard. I thought it would be interesting to show you, if you can just indicate time to me. I know I'm running off quickly as well. Once I know I have limited time, I also speak fast. So please let me know.
You're still good.
Okay, so social enterprise within the SSE is a spectrum. So both SSE, like I said, and social enterprise is a huge spectrum. For example, you get models that are like donor community partnership models. So for example, if you remember during COVID, we had the community action networks, the can networks that were trying to cover food security issues at the time of the COVID shocks. So these are informal distribution networks that fall as SSE. Then, for example, you have Food Forward SA that Tasneem mentioned last week, which is a pure nonprofit but acting within the food security side. Or, for example, SA Harvest, which also does food rescue, and they do cooked meals for vulnerable groups. Then, for example, you have cooperative structures, which I think we can work a whole lot more on in South Africa as an opportunity. And these ones are models that are primarily like often worker-owned. So it's the workers that own the business or member-owned. So it's the members that own the business. For example, there's a good example of the Park Slope Food Co-op in the US, where as a member, you volunteer, and by volunteering, you earn credits. And by earning credits, you're able to then buy from the supermarket, and they have multiples of different other businesses that are operating within that. And you do find, for example, some farming collectives. There are a few in South Africa, but they're just not visible, where they operate with this cooperative model where you subscribe and you usually then earn what the yield is for that season, which is good because I think these kind of models help, for example, to cover the risk that associated, for example, with farming in the conditions that we're in. And then we have the Harvest of Hope, which I'm not sure if it's still operating. For example, with a cooperative of farmers, where these farmers in urban areas are linked to market in order to sell their produce that they have. Then we have your hybrid structures. So I included here because I'm not sure if this season you're going to be learning about the unexplored Cape Town, or it's called the African Food Styling Tour, where they have a pure profit earning business. For example, it's an ecotourism business that links to food as heritage. And then, for example, it on the other side, it has a nonprofit that is now raising funding in order to support these food actors that they're making visible in the CBD, for example. You have the Oranjezicht City Farms that works in that model as well. And then you have Abalobi. I don't know if you know Abalobi. It's a social enterprise that works with fishing communities, where they have a nonprofit that is focused on creating tools and resources and capacity building of the fishers. I don't know if we say fishermen. And then you have the for-profit or income-generating arm, which is the like the food fish with a story, which is a digital marketplace that links and shortens the chain between chefs, for example, and the fish that the farmers are busy the fisheries are catching. Which is cool. Then, for example, we have an old you'll hear more about it just now, Fresh Life Produce, who initially started as a nonprofit, but they've also now started to create spin-off organizations to enable the model to be sustainable. Then you have like your earned income, which is more your organizations that are profit earning, normally registered as your PTYs. They have a good mission behind it, and they provide income earning opportunities to people that are marginalized. They're normally structured like that, where they're creating employment opportunities for young people or for people or people with disabilities, for example, but they're designed as for-profit businesses with care. And what you find also is also you see this blurred kind of tech space. where you have organizations that are reaching and making impact, for example, by including small-scale farmers. However, by their nature and their interaction, they are for-profit startup kind of organization. And you can see that even they're participating and collaborating with, for example, corporate supply chains, for example. Or you have some that, as you know, tech, it sometimes is very difficult to be profitable, where they haven't really defined the economic model yet, and they have impact, but they're really operating purely as a tech startup, and not much yet as a social enterprise. Then I wanted to include the context of, like, there's also other models that exist that really are driven by impact investment, which I think is also quite good in bridging this tech startup in the food system area, where there's a great example. It's a complementary sector. It's in the waste economy, called the Social Factory by Oxfam. I think it's an amazing project where they have formalized informal waste pickers into owning a trust and a social enterprise. And that social enterprise is owned by the informal waste pickers and by Oxfam as a shareholder. And for example, they were given land by the city of Johannesburg. I think that is amazing because it shows how collaboration can really unlock opportunity in social entrepreneurship. And the model of it is that they would then upcycle or recycle this waste that they're collecting, plastic waste, into corporate chains, for example, like Unilever. So I think that's amazing because it also balances the negotiation and the power dynamics in these exchanges and transactions. And then, for example, you have One Farm Share, which was a baby of Standard Bank, operating as a social enterprise and obviously has that base. I think the thing with social enterprises that we need to work with a lot, and SSEs, is creating a base of safety, right? So for example, what they're doing is that they work with farmers that are wanting to commercialize. And what they do is that they take the produce and then they redirect it to organizations like SA Harvest that are doing food rescue. And at the same time, what they're doing is then they're then building the capacity of these small scale farmers in order to achieve their goals. Because some far small scale farmers do want to be commercial farmers, and we need to respect that. For me, my challenge would be, let's make sure that it's done in a way that is sustainable. The next kind of, I'll go into a few examples, small or big, that we've mentioned before. So you may know Roots and Raw. It's Oribe alumni. They have been in the social enterprise for a long time, game for a long time. They are a well-being social enterprise that promotes accessible well-being through a plant-based lifestyle, self-care practices, and inclusion, for example, of home growers in the wellness value chain. So they will always say they're not a juice company. So they're all those sentences there. And they're amazing. It's a couple, it's a family business that launched this business based off of their own precarity, and live the lifestyle that they are selling. So they have a very clear mission, and they're now strengthening and understanding how to have a stronger environmental mission in their business. However, for example, they initially, when they started, was to create affordable health for communities, but what was happening is that that was not generating any revenue or income for them to be able to sustain. And one of the things that came through, and I'm not sure if you're going to be meeting them in the BTG, is that they kind of reworked their model in such a way where they could generate revenue from people who can afford, but then that would enable them to continue doing the work which they're passionate about, which is the community-led health initiative. So the what they're doing reinvests into that work that they're doing. And also, what I love about the concept is that they're mainstreaming health through important social infrastructures. So you'll see here, this says 21 Daniel Fast. If anyone knows, it's typically a faith-based fast. I see during Ramadan, they do work around faith-based fast because faith is a huge social infrastructure in South Africa. So they're using that to kind of mainstream this health concept that sometimes can be abstract and inaccessible within these social infrastructures that exist. I know they do a lot of work with mothers as well. and other people who are sort of running homes where they make food to people so that they can enable them as well, which I think is good. And I think they show that like they have an adaptive and resilient model. And it'll be interesting to see, are they happy where they are, or where would they like to go next with their model? Because I know they're quite strict about their values and how their organization works. Then we have Fresh Life Produce, which aims to combat food security. So they are about helping people to produce their own food. So initially, when this entrepreneur started, they started with aquaponics. Yeah. And they were setting up their own aquaponics systems, and it was not working in the township because firstly, aquaponics, the fish that is suitable for that is not really in the diet of where he was placing these aquaponics, and it was just too complicated as a system at that time. It's a long time ago. I'm sure a lot has changed. So then he started developing these systems. Firstly, because people don't have space, but they still need access to making food, where you can either have two of these items, you can have a greenhouse. He has a setup in collaboration with Soft, where he has a rooftop garden at Kenilworth Centre Mall. So it's really malleable technology that he's created. And also part of the system is that it consumes less energy, consumes less water, and it's quite easy to use and apply. I know there's another social entrepreneur in our network who was using it with people with disabilities because it's quite accessible as well in that regard, for example, and to be able to work from. So I think what is great about their model is that they have partnered with institutions. So what they've done is that are running programs around agriculture, agri-food, youth development. So for example, he recently ran an agri-skills program with Mr. Price Foundation, for example, where they were training these young farmers. And to establish community-based agri hubs. So his passion in the end actually is to set up hubs in community structures that already exist. So if there's a cooperative, for example, that is doing beading or beadwork or creative work, is that, hey, this is a platform that you can easily integrate a system like this and transition or add a feature of an agri hub in your place. And I think that is great. So it means that then he gets partners like UNDP, a few other, I can't remember which ministries, which are in who were interested because of the integration factor of his model. And then the profits that are generated from there, because he sells the systems, are then reinvested into the training programs, improving the systems, and subsidizing community projects. So he also deploys these systems into directly into township communities for people who cannot afford them to grow these systems. The ultimate dream that I know of is that he would want to start developing products. So it's not only about self-sufficiency, but community or sufficiency. So how could the produce that's been grown within this start to create a system where you collectively create products, then enter into whatever markets and distribution networks you have? I don't know if I can mention the one that he was working on because I don't know if it's a public thing. And then, like I mentioned about Abalobi, I've spoken quite a lot about this one around how it's about empowering small scale fishers, using tech tools in order to drive sustainable fishing. And I think also to create earning opportunities, better earning opportunities for the small scale fisheries. And then through the fish with a story is creating market access and closer links to different actors within the system, like chefs and the small scale fisheries, so that you can drive an economy there and an alternative economy there. And
And
I would
perhaps,
amend, yes.
just a time check, we have about 10 minutes left.
Okay, cool. And I think what is great about that model is that really from the beginning, it started as a research project, and I think that is what is so great about SSEs and social enterprises. They have dynamic starts, right? It's not all well defined. So it started as a research project, and then now has evolved into a social enterprise, and that is really through the inclusion, the co-creation of the small scale fisheries, and even now, even impacting women participation in these fishery communities, and creating product development. So they really work with involvement of community in developing solutions. And you can concretely see that the benefits, which is the income generation, are going to the small scale farmers. Then I thought it would be nice to share some really other ones that I find really cool that I would love to see in South Africa. As you know, Oribe is part of Group SOS, which is a French-based social enterprise. And within one of the 700 structures, they're like the SSE Bidvest. So in a good way. So they have a there's a chain called Andy, which is a chain of solidarity grocery stores. So these grocery stores are food that has been rescued. And then what happens is that they apply social pricing in these stores. So anyone can walk into, it's almost like street store, if you remember the street store concept, where anyone can go into the store with a card, you can shop. And depending on whether you have the financial means, you pay a certain price. And for example, people who are homeless are now living in the streets, for example, or people who do not have income are also able to come and buy in the store. And it's there's no differentiation between what loaf of bread you get and a person who's working somewhere, the loaf of bread they get. And I think what is amazing about their model is that they've integrated both this pricing and revenue generation, income generation, but also they've really done well to generate grants and donations that have helped them to scale. So as you can see now, their scaling model, they've developed an incubator where they're now training anyone. So anyone as a community can go to them, and then they can upskill them and train them to start their own solidarity grocery store. And I think that is amazing in the context of, I feel it's weird that with people who are reliant on SASSA, that we're paying the same price for goods. To me, it's a little bit of a weird structure. Then another interesting one, I don't know how to say the word, but this is a third place in the sense that what they did is they repurposed a building structure that was abandoned and empty, and they turned it into a food-focused community place. So in that space, there's a food market that promotes other solidarity-based food entrepreneurs. They have a shared kitchen that promotes catering services that are focused on solidarity. And for example, then they have the space that's open for other NGOs and other civil society partners to come and run free programs. So you'll find that during the week, they also have like these food workshops that are happening in the space where citizens can come and cook together. There's an urban garden within that space as well. So they can pick the food, they can cook together, learn together, share meals, and it's obviously it strengthens the bonds in the communities. I think this is also something that is really would be really great in our context to have more of, especially if you think of the growth and the interest that is growing with indigenous foods and our food style. And food choices, there definitely needs to be more centering of our food style. At the moment, of course, we see it in retail and we see it in informal trade. However, I think there needs to be a link to the social cohesion and creating bonds and to the sustainable agri-food system. That would be a great thing to see in our places. Then, because I know it's hard, and I don't want to make it seem like the journey that you're on, we don't re recognize that it's hard. If some of you might have come here just as pure food entrepreneurs and don't have an interest in social enterprise, so you're like, Oribe, what are you talking about? Some of you are social entrepreneurs and you're struggling in that journey, and that struggle is real because in the South African context, I think the real structural barriers to you guys setting up businesses that can grow and scale. And this is because social and solidarity economy enterprises can only thrive in countries with these kind of businesses and small businesses, cooperatives, social enterprises have state backing. But we know that our South African policies favor big business and foreign investment, for example. Then also the financial system treats a social entrepreneur as a normal entrepreneur, which is wrong because social enterprises are not really profit maximizing. Sometimes they do not have the high collateral because they're based on partnerships, and they are not profit first kind of growth. And then also we have a situation where consumers are disconnected from alternative economic models. And that's why I think we need to learn and we need to re elevate and valorize the informal food economy, how it's become a center of our food economies, because then that helps us to kind of create that close link to people and social entrepreneurship. And then also, I think, which is a big thing, and we emphasize a lot in this incubator, South Africa is still very much pushing for entrepreneurship as an individual survival strategy rather than a collective economic transformation. And I think the value of being in an incubator and in an incubator that recognizes like a Ribi is that we need to start plugging each other into these mini alternative economies that we're creating and creating collaborations. I don't know how much time I have. So as you know, I do challenge social entrepreneurs, I do challenge incubators, hubs that we should be advocating and we should be fighting for an ecosystem and an economy that helps social enterprises thrive. And we should be fighting to get a legal entity in this way that can drive incentivization in supply chains of contracting with social enterprises and also incentivizing the social and the economic impacts that are coming out of social enterprises. I think we need to stop, even though I do value corporate supply chains, but we also need to stop fighting to get into them because they're not for us. They're not really made for us until there's going to be a structural change there. So we should fight for that structural change, but we should also try to collectively create alternative networks. I think we need to fight for non-extractive capital, so more grants going to social enterprises and social and solidarity economies, more blended capital, more social bonds. I haven't seen a social bond that is linked to food security in South Africa, and more community financing. I think we underestimate the value of the money that we have within our communities and how that can be a financing structure. If you look at stokvels, I forgot to mention stokvel falls under SSEs. And then again, like I said, shifting more to shared ownership, resilience, and then also knowing that you guys alone can't fight this unjust system is that as hubs, as academia, as policymakers, as everyone, we need to rally behind your work. And make sure that it improves. And but from our side is to make sure that you set up strong business and viable models, and then also to place you at the center of economic recovery. I'm not sure if I have any more time. It was just some tips of how to survive in this challenging economy that you're in. For me, start small and scale gradually. And this is by piloting ideas on a small scale, iterating based on real-world feedback, and particularly through partnerships. So leverage partnerships by firstly partnering with the people and the places you're solving for. Cross-sectoral collaborations, whether it's public, other social enterprises, organizations, and business entities, because you can piggyback on shared resources and their infrastructure. And then stay resilient and adaptable by taking care of your mental health and well-being, and then also participating in a community of support that is so important. Then also make sure that you find the right mentors. I struggle with mentors, but find the right mentors who can help you navigate the challenges. I know people who have five. They have a life mentor, they have a business mentor, they have a mom mentor, parenthood mentor. What works for you, but find the right mentors. Most of it is to help you think through because you already know the solutions, but you need a co-thinking partner. Then cash flow, if you have cash, be vigilant about it, whether it's small or big. Evaluate whether the expenditure that you're going to make, what is the value and the size of the impact it's going to have on your social enterprise. Show off and show up fearlessly. So don't be afraid of telling your narrative. I told you guys the last time we spoke about. And so that you can draw in a community and then show up in spaces. Don't be afraid of showing up in spaces that we think are typically for academics, for activists, or for startups. Show up. If it's relevant to your work in any way, show up in that space, so that your voice can be heard. And then also, like we're saying, around the building alternative networks, more trying to find direct consumer models, using for informal trade as an alliance or co-creator, and then also collective bargaining and collective buying as a resource, and shared what you learned around in circularity is important, I think, for our survival and our thriving.
Thank you very much. There's a lot that I think we can unpack there. And first, I want to say, when you started in Tux, you said social and solidarity economy is radical. So just because you are a social enterprise doesn't necessarily mean that you are doing some of these radical principles. But then towards the end, you also said, oh, actually, stockpiles are also part of social and solidarity economy, which then made me remember that actually a lot of these principles we know. We know mutual aid, we know stockpile, we know what it means to come together and to club together like we did during COVID with the community action networks. So it's interesting that when we start to talk about these things with other language like social and solidarity economy, it can sound like this new big thing. But actually, a lot of these principles, we know them. We know what it means to work together with others. And I guess the radical part for me that really came up from hearing what you had to share was that it's radical to think that entrepreneurship can be something other than purely competitive. Because what you're saying is we can work together. And so I think it just, there's so much food for thought here about how you set up a business, how you can partner with people, and also partnering with the people who you're solving for, rather than trying to partner with the big grocery store chains. Because, I always like to say, corporate money is nice, but you're going to have to dance a big dance before you get it. So, there's a lot of factors at play there. So, yeah, just like so much to unpack. But I want to start with a question of what support is available for somebody who wants to be a social enterprise in South Africa. They want to do all these radical things, and they're like, it feels like I am going it alone. I mean, I know you've said like there's mentors, et cetera, that you can get, but like business is hard. Running a business is so hard. And it's what support is there actually out there to navigate even just this mind shift change that you need to make to be more radical and then still run a business as well?
Thank you for that. So, I do think that the support system is underdeveloped in our country. We definitely need more hubs, and we need more hubs that are hyperlocal, in order to create that support system. So, you get hubs or incubators like Oribe, you get institutions like the Bertha Center of Social Innovation, who are setting up programs. In townships, for example, you also have universities that have programs for budding social entrepreneurs that are there. And they all have varying accessibility. But I think reaching out to any one of those platforms, even if you cannot get in within their network and community yet, they will definitely know another actor that is fitting to it. And then also, I think what happens is that social enterprise is broad, but you get institutions like the creative CDI, which is for creatives, which could fall under social entrepreneurship, right? Or you have other entities that are specialized in manufacturing that could fall under social entrepreneurship. So I think for me, it's to reach out to whatever is accessible to you at that time because you will get redirected. The system is quite small. Sometimes it might, unfortunately, it might mean you're going from this point to this point to this point. But I think because our value is about building together, whatever interaction you're going to have with any one of those institutions, you already get food for thought and nuggets. Then also on the internet, there's quite a lot of courses and e-learning that are geared for social entrepreneurs. Like you say, they may be difficult because we've been doing this social enterprise thing and the language is quite technical, but I think there are free resources that can be done there. Then also using the internet to research who is successful in this space. It's hard because it's quite invisible and there's a lot of work that we need to do, but also approaching other social entrepreneurs that have navigated the social entrepreneurship journey. Because even in a once-off, if you can get a social entrepreneur who's like successful on a once-off meeting, that can set you far ahead and giving you nuggets, giving you questions to answer, which helps you to then also start to do the research part. I often find that entrepreneurs wait too long and sit too long with the idea without going out and testing its validity and its desirability. So I would champion those kind of support systems as knowing that they exist.
Yeah, I hear that. And those are some great organizations that you've just mentioned, as well as places for people to reach out to if they're looking for specific types of support. And it's so true that impact community has really grown over the, over the last while, and there are resources that are available now, even for particular interest groups, sometimes resources for, people of color, women. So there's a lot out there. I wonder then, in this broader umbrella term of social and solidarity economy, does every business model, or like, can any business be under this model? Or are there some businesses where you're like, it doesn't really make sense for you to be under this umbrella, that you should be something else? It wouldn't really work for you to be part of this SSE kind of umbrella.
I do think so. I can't think of examples off of my head. Like I mentioned earlier, there's always this tension between profit and impact, right? And you find that some institutions like Root and Raw can be agile and can transform the business model to integrate both. But you may find that some models or some entities cannot find the economic model to do it unless it's purely for profit. That's why sometimes you do get the other split of the split of a pure for-profit organization going there. So I wouldn't say that all business models can fall under that. And also, not all business models that describe themselves as impact models are impact models. They, for example, have like a CSI initiative, but they are not a CSI. And I know it's a big question that we have, like in a country where we have 70% youth employment, if I'm starting a business and it's employing youth, is it not a social enterprise? And I think in some ways it may not work in SSE. But also that is because of the lack of the state backing. I think more to think of the future, if we want a future that is sustainable, we absolutely need to be thinking about business models that are falling within the SSE. Otherwise, they are not the anti-future and anti-sustainable future. So I don't know if any of you know the donut economics. What's her name? Kate Raworth, I think. She's brave, and she said, like, in the future, some of these organizations won't exist, and these corporates, they won't exist. Because there's absolutely no way they will be able to fit in an economy that we need for the future, which is an inclusive and a sustainable future. So I think that's also important to understand that, yes, they might find a profitable model, but in the future, they're not designed for the future that we need in order to sustain life in all its forms. So it's a long-winded way of asking it, but I couldn't directly say, oh, this type of business model, whether it's B2C, B2B, works or doesn't work. I do know that some are harder. In the SSE, for example, the B2B business to business design kind of structures, they're much harder. That's why for me, I champion around creating alternative networks that close the consumer distribution networks, at least.
Yeah, I mean, kind of when you were answering there, I was thinking of that slide that you had with the kind of Oribe social enterprise checklist, which I think is then so helpful to say, okay, if we're building an organization that is future fit, and this organization is based on these principles, then this is an organization that will be at its core, it will be collaborative, it will respect the communities that it's solving for, you know, it will have distribution of ownership, etc. So then all of those things are baked in, and then you can kind of know that right from the beginning you are starting on these radical principles anyway, and so then you can just build from there, which seems to make a lot of sense.
Exactly. And I think you mentioned a good point that it's malleable also. Like the expectation, we don't have the expectation that you're ticking all that checklist because we understand that we're operating in a challenger economy. But to understand that these are ways in which you can continue to innovate to be future fit, I think you put it so perfectly. And then also to also know you're not a social enterprise. That's also a decision that needs to be made because actually, the conversation that I was talking about earlier about social entrepreneurship, the person was advocating for nonprofits in that he sees social enterprises as trying to eliminate nonprofits. And it's like, no, nonprofits, informal networks that are partnership, community, donor-driven are valid and important within the structure where we have an economy that's not working and is on the dysfunctional side. So there's also that decision to make that no, maybe it's not a social enterprise because once you make that decision, it's also going to be able to help you to be able to map out, which we'll be talking about a lot more in the incubation program, your business model. What are the key activities? Who are the right partners and allies? What is the value proposition that you're building? What are the revenue channels? What is the cost of this thing? Because if you've defined your model and setting up yourself as a right model for what you want to solve, then it's a little bit easier to also drive to market with that business model.
So it's like the principles come first and then the business model, which leads me to my next question is, can you say, okay, I started a business that was not a social enterprise, but the social enterprise stuff sounds really good. I just want to sprinkle some of it into my business. Can you do that and then
No,
turn it
that's
into
kind of what
a
she is.
social enterprise?
I definitely think so. I think that's the value of what already exists. And you'll notice in our communication, we don't emphasize a lot around social entrepreneurship, but focus a lot around food entrepreneurs because we believe that you can integrate these principles within your business. Because that's what we should be all be trying, whether you're a big enterprise or a small enterprise anyway. So for example, we have a very good example, Kaya. Lucas can help me, Kaya's business name. He is a farmer that's based in the townships in Cape Town. And he joined the incubator. And I remember when we went to see his farm, firstly, his farm is running on a communal land. And then he has gardens that he's running in schools. And then he has cooperative models where he brings small scale farmers together in order to meet certain transactions, for example. So it's a cooperative, it's not formalized yet, but it's a cooperative. And he said, oh, I didn't realize that actually I am a social enterprise. And now I have can distinguish myself actually, even with the positioning of my business, because I'm realizing that I am a social enterprise and there's a community for social entrepreneurs that is helping to navigate these challenges. Because for me, it's great to have these networks and this community to navigate these challenges. So I believe, but I am a hopeless believer, but I do believe that any enterprise can transition to social entrepreneurship, particularly because it's a spectrum. If it cannot transition to social entrepreneurship, that's where I'm overly radical as well, that you don't belong in today and the economy, because you're not future fit and you're not fit for an economy that is supposed to be inclusive and that's supposed to be sustainable and equitable.
But I think that's actually really hopeful when you say that, because initially when you started explaining, I was like, I don't know. I feel like you have to be social from the beginning. But as you were explaining, then it gave me a lot of hope to say that, it also means when you start a business, we know that at the beginning of a business, a lot of things are messy, right? Like you're figuring out a lot of things are imperfect, and you just have to like keep going. What you're explaining here is it's okay that you are imperfect at the beginning, even in your being a social enterprise, that you can figure out the parts that need to be figured out, and that's fine. And I think maybe that's sometimes what makes these topics seem so big is that, wow, you first need to get a master's degree, from a top university to understand the language, and then you have to think it clearly and whatever. And what I'm understanding you saying now is, no, you start and you fix and you make better and you iterate, which is kind of like what you would have done with a business anyway. But what you are optimizing for is you're optimizing for social. And as we say,
The
this like
principles.
exactly.
Yes.
Okay, you've
Yeah.
convinced me,
I
fine.
believe so. I can be challenged, but I truly believe that that is a possibility and a route to try. And that is why I say that we need to create an enabling environment in order for these kind of institutions that are being born or being formalized or being strengthened. Because like I said, social entrepreneurship is something that we can really say it's been active in our, I believe our, okay, I'm not going to get political. Anyway, so social entrepreneurship has been operating in our social economy for a long time. If you listen to some of the businesses that supported the liberation struggle, they sound like social entrepreneurs to me. So I've lost my train of thought now because I did something that I said I wasn't going to do. But what I'm saying is basically what I'm saying is that it's also to remember that these models do already currently exist. It's that they're not supported enough. So when you're finding it hard, figure out, are you finding it hard because the model doesn't work? Or are you finding it hard because there isn't an enabling environment, so you need to join a support system? Are you finding it hard because what you've seen works at a small scale and you need to raise up your voice so that the people that are making policies and creating enabling environments are able to create instruments that are designed for your model to scale if you're seeking to scale and reach more impact? Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Kaya's company, AgriKey Farming. Thank you, Lucas. Added it in the chat. Lucas also added a link where he presented about his business. Okay, I want to go to the questions in the chat. Jacantha, welcome back. I see your comment here saying you might fall under well-being social enterprise in the future. You're wondering, based on your work in circular economy space, can we look at the social and solidarity economy model with a business model in the context of climate or environment? So I just want to understand, is your question like, how does all of this, or how do these principles change if you're talking about climate or environment work? Is that the question?
It's a mishmash. Good morning. So I'm basically in the skincare space where I like grow the ingredients that I would use. So it's obviously the oils come directly from the farmers. But I've also done a lot of circular things that are happening. Like basically on the side, it's like I would collect waste printer paper and that would become seed paper that would be used to give to the customer so you can grow your herbs and veggies. And there's other things now that I'm doing on the side with clothing that's being brought that I would use like spa accessories and stuff. But now it's like I've been doing a lot of things like with coaching with youth, which I didn't know was called social enterprise. I call it volunteering. And now it's like I'm learning about these new models and these other things with SDGs. And I'm trying to see test the business case model and MVP and the new things that I'm doing. How do you like reel it in and focus? I love that you said start small because I have an idea of what I want to do, but now to bring in the community, figure this out, and it just feels like it's expanding and I want to reel it in. So where would you say would be like the starting point? Do I like just bring in some of the existing stuff or start with the new stuff and then piece it together? I love the raw or something, and because that gives me an idea, but like that's basically my missed
Yeah,
my
but
question.
I think they're actually having a similar journey to you. And I think what I've noticed is that they have what their priority was like, okay, we need to be sustainable as a business, financially viable as a business. So that is a goal that we're going to go for, because going for that goal, they were able to distinguish, is going to enable us to be able to achieve the social goals and the environmental goals that are more collective and that are more community-led driven. And it's similar to what you're saying is, and I think that's what can be confusing about SSEs, is that it's interconnected. So like food systems are in interconnected. So for me, I would go on an exercise of trying to identify what are the key activities that I'm doing. Looking at what is the value proposition of each one of them, because remember, an SSE, in my perspective, it doesn't have to be only social and only environmental. It can be both
Yes.
as well. And then being able to understand which one of these models works like a community-based model, and which one of these models works like an income generating model. And then also to be able to take it back, if you have a very clear problem statement, because the problem statement is important, and you have a clear mission, which one of these activities fit in with the mission? Because sometimes that's how we can get into what we call mission creep or scope creep. Because we're trying to find the sustainability, because we're trying to add all these kind of things. Tasneem will tell you, she's very much about, let us all admit that it is challenging to integrate all these factors in. And therefore, it's important to also acknowledge that it's difficult to do it. So again, when I say start small, it's also start with identifying what works first. And maybe one thing is a phase zero thing, one is a phase one, one is a phase two. One is some of the things you have to let go, right? And do a collaboration with another entity that's possibly doing that, and you bring in your aspects so that you can combine. That's the best advice I could give now. I think it's hopelessly dreaming to integrate social, circularity, environmental in the economy that we live. And I think that's why we need to be gentle and easy with ourselves. And also we need to identify what do we have bandwidth for and what is working quite early, so that we can map out what is our growth trajectory, because that's also something that is important. I would say that as well. And with the social aspect, again, it's going back to the checklist and asking yourself, is there more collective governance that could come in this? Is there more decision making that could come with this? Is there an ownership model that could come through this, like similar to what Andy's doing, where you can do social franchising that would come through this, where yes, maybe the initiation was my social enterprise, but now handing it over the model to the community in order to be able to do it themselves. And then going up that ladder of that checklist to kind of figure all the time, it's because it's an iterative process. What are the social principles that you can integrate or not integrate within your goals? And remember what I said as well is understanding the social infrastructure that surrounds your business model and your community and the places that you're in, because I think there's a lot of room for innovation and partnership-based innovation there as well.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Love the answer.
Great. we have another question here. How do we get funding? And so I want to expand the question to say, how do social enterprises land funding? And so, yeah, then specifically if we talk about for mixed agriculture.
So that is a difficult one because it depends on how you are registered, first of all, in order to know what kind of funding you can access. And that funding is difficult to access even in the South African context, even if you identified what entity that you are. So, like I said, the ones that are hybrid, what has that what that has added is that they're able to source funding from channels such as corporate social risk initiatives, CSI, or for example, from foundations. Food security and food systems is actually a key pillar in a lot of countries, particularly in a lot of financing and DF development banks or development financing. So you are in the right sector where people are wanting to give money to. So with that nonprofit kind of structure, it's easier to access that kind of money. Then with a PTY structure, that's where it becomes a little bit more difficult, because you are then having to access your government-based funding channels, like depending on your age group, your NYDAs, your CIFAs, your NEFs, which we know that it's a marathon to get there. And then there is this bubble, and you'll be learning about, I'm not sure if we're going to touch up on about it within the Bridging the Gender context, but definitely in the incubation, we look at the funding landscape. There is this new bubble of what we call impact investors. These are investors who are driven to give financing to you, but they do want to see social return, and most of the time they want to see high reach. And we've seen quite a few that are coming up that are specifically focused on agri-food. And then, for example, there's also new models. If you have a profitable or an income-generating model that's going on, where we are seeing what is called innovative on debt finance, where it's either no interest or zero interest that can be applied for. The man for that is Lucas. He is in the ecosystem, really trying to identify these channels of funding that are accessible and supporting social entrepreneurs to understand which channels are you are able to access funding from. And then also what the nice thing with as a PTY, I'm not sure necessarily as a not-profit company, is that there's another layer, even though we know there's contention around the triple BEE, where money is supposed to be geared towards enterprise supplier development. So again, that is a channel that you can explore. Look at the JSE and look at which companies are in the agri-food sector, or look at even your medium companies, because those are easier to access, which are in the agri-food sector. And I'm giving fundraising tips now, not necessarily telling you where to get funding. Sorry about that. But like, then you look for the person that's responsible for ESD or transformation within that organization and find out what instruments could they possibly have. And you may find that there's opportunities also and funding channels through that as well, I would say.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the question as well. Lots of really good tips there about how to also think about going about looking for money. Okay, our final question from Puleng. Welcome back. What is your question?
Hi, thank you so much. This was super inspiring and just like touched all of the places in my heart. So I appreciate you so much. I think that my question is kind of, it links to your answer to Jacantha, but it's kind of coming from a different direction in that, like in a normal business, you have a product and then it's, you can develop a narrative for that product, right? But the thing is quite easy. Here's the thing. And if you are a product-based social enterprise, you can also say, the reason my product is cool is because of the story and the validity of why that product exists. But if you're coming at it from kind of the opposite direction and you're like, and you're solving for system problems, right? You kind of inevitably have this creep. Because if I come up with a systems problem, my narrative is messy because if I look at it from this way, I'm looking at gender. If I look at it from this way, I'm looking at environment. I'm looking at So like it's so crafting your story, are you supposed to like have seven different documents depending on who you're applying to say that you're valid in that specific space? Or are you supposed to say this is the full scope? Like I'm interested in experimental citizenship, right? And future cities. Like how do we, but then what? You know what I mean? Like this is a very messy kind of proposition that's quite hard to sell unless someone's willing to like sit down with you, go through documents, like listen to you ramble. And that's not good for business, surely. So just your advice on if you're coming from the opposite direction and try and coming in through like systems thinking rather than product thinking.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's Oribe's challenge, to be honest, as well.
You're doing a
We're
great job.
actually a
You're doing
climate
such a
action.
good
Do
job.
you know that? We're actually an organization action. Do you know that? So I think it has both is positive, and again, it's what also makes it hard to be a social entrepreneur. Like I remember in the beginning when I was saying, because you exist and contribute, especially if you're systems driven, to so many different sectors that are now still currently operating in silos. So it's challenging because then when you're in a certain space, you define yourself in this way. When you're in a certain place, you define in this way. What I would say is, I think the core narrative should be well defined, and it should be well defined to answer the problem, right? Then what you can do is with that core narrative is that then when you are in these different platforms and these different opportunities for either generating partnerships or funding or community partnerships, you emphasize a narrative that speaks to the language that they have, but you don't change what the core problem and the core solution that you have, right? And then I think the other challenge that you have with a product-based social enterprise is that you have to do quite a lot of education, right? So it's you then have to integrate the fact that education is going to be part of your business model, and educating either the consumer or the buyer about the value of this product. But don't forget at the end of the day that we've all been trained to buy in a certain way and aspire to buy in a certain way. So as a product, you need to also speak to that. So we're recently working with a manufacturing company, and they do amazing products. However, what they were selling as a selling point is not something that is sellable to the person that needs to buy or needs to consume the product. So it was like, how do you balance like this value? Because it's the core, it's not going to change because it's your business model, right? But then how do you then also create a narrative? It can be word or it can be visually that speaks to how consumers and buyers purchase, right? But also knowing that you have to do education, because people, like I said, consumers are far from alternatives and alternative economy. So it's difficult to be able to balance both. So I don't have a clear answer, but for me, it's internally get the narrative, the problem, and the mission and the solution, right? What is the business model? And then the hard part is that whichever platform that you're in, you emphasize the narrative that you emphasize. And then also you start, as time goes by and the years go by, I think your experience and your listening to the feedback of what's happening on the ground and in your business helps to even strengthen actually that narrative. So I wouldn't say try to have it all figured out now. Because either way, it's going to oversimplify what you're doing, but be fully cautious of the narrative and where and how you apply that narrative. And as you build your business going forward, you go straight. I think it's an opportunity, like I said, as well, because it means that you can talk to different audiences and generate different resources for your business, the social enterprise. But it's hard work, it's extra work. I
Perfect.
definitely think that there is also quite a lot of comms and advocate, I don't know if Monash is here, work that needs to be provided as a support system for social enterprises about that building narratives and building narratives that generate resources for social enterprises. There's not enough of that that is happening because even if you go to a standard marketing agency or any other communications agency, they don't get it right. So I think there's a lot
But
more
also,
work that needs to be done.
if you're in a
Pardon?
poly crisis, if you're in a poly crisis, you're in a multifaceted crisis, then even having a clear problem statement becomes difficult. You can't say my problem is late stage capitalism. You know what I mean? That's you.
Yes, the problem
My
economy, but the
problem
solution
is the
can.
culture that we live in. That's, you know.
Yes. The problem will be that's already challenged. The problem is multifaceted, but our solution is one.
Okay.
And we apply that lens through any solution. So if next year you see Oribe is doing cultural entrepreneurship, you shouldn't be surprised because you know that our solution is one. It's social entrepreneurship to navigate the poverty, unemployment, rapid urbanization, climate action. But our solution is one. So you are right. You are right that the problem, I think, is just be clear about the interlanguages and how you express it. And again, you can educate your customer using social media as well and your community using social media and other platforms to have and unpack this conversation. And we need to do it more and more. And sometimes that's why I'm careful when I say that I sound like I'm absolute, but I'm not absolute. So even when I'm talking in platforms, I forget. And I'm like, no, the real thing is that corporates need to do this and this and this. But I'm here to talk for social enterprises because I believe that they have agency and they can also do what they do. So we have to continuously name it and mention it, especially because it's a new way of communicating and language around the poly crisis, but it's the reality. And there is a niche, there's a community that gets you.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's
Great.
growing, and the community is growing. You know, for so long, it's like you've had to fit yourself into a small box, but the community is growing. I just wanted to shout out one tool that I'm sure will come up in the incubation program, which is the theory of change, which I think is very helpful for laying out, especially things are complex, right? And laying out, like, if we do all of these things, this is the lasting change that we get to. So, if combating late stage capitalism is the lasting thing that we do, being able to lay it out can also just help to detangle things in your mind and build your narrative. So, shout out theory of change.
Yes, definitely. That's another
Great.
tool, actually. Yeah. What is the end goal?
Yes, exactly. So with that, folks, we are at time. I know we could talk about this for ages, but that will have to be at another time. I want to say thank you, first of all, to you, Ntaks, for teaching us so much about social and solidarity economy, and I guess for reminding us most of all that we know this, we know how to work with others, and so we need to get back to the knowledge that we already have within us. So thank you for that. I want to thank you all who have joined here today to get this knowledge for the discussion, the questions as well. And then I want to hand over to Lucas, who's going to give us the final official word of the morning and send us on our way. Thanks very much, Lucas.
Cool. Thank you so much, to me and the talks. This was a quite insightful and engaging conversation. I think definitely couldn't have rounded it off with the questions and comments that came at the very end. It is quite a complex space, but it's not to say that it is impossible to activate, participate, and engage on an effective a way that helps us to, you know, get over the late stage capitalism phase that we're at. It's actually an interesting concept that I'm gonna start reading about now because I do believe we are definitely in the late stages of the capitalist system, and the social solidarity economy is growing stronger and stronger. The community is getting broader and broader, and it is really an effective and efficient, not to say sustain, not to even, you know, go towards mentioning how sustainably or how sustainable it is. and can be in bridging all these areas of crisis that we face in the world that we live in today. So, yeah, power to all you social entrepreneurs pushing forward with your social enterprises and trying to make an impact in all the various ways that you are definitely in the in a good space. And I love how this conversation also kind of weaved into conversations how your business model and how you can build towards making a great impact in the space should be taken into consideration. I almost fell off my chair hearing some of the comments and thinking to myself that those that are engaged on Babele should have a kind of aha moment to realize that, hey, actually the work that I'm engaged in and the activities that I'm completing can help to support the thinking process around, okay, I want to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, but how do I now distill that in a manner that helps me to focus and kind of become effective and efficient in developing this business that I would like to have in society and solving some of these problems. So yeah, all the best. Continued to
Just one more
be
word.
in
Can I
full
just say one
support.
more word?
Yes,
Sorry,
we'll
Lucas.
do.
I just
No
want to
worries. Please go for it.
reemphasize about the point around well-being and mental health. It's a we set high standards for ourselves naturally as people in the space, right? Of food system, social entrepreneurship in whatever which way. And don't be afraid to see Oribi Incubator and connecting with people like Lucas, Zamile, and whatever coaches or mentors you're going to be with, as people who are going to create a safe space for you to be able to unpack that. Oftentimes, I see entrepreneurs that have a lot of potential, and then I go back again, and they've gone from the system, and there's not even an idea that this is what's happening. So be open about those. In the safe space of Aribi, but then also be open about speaking, not necessarily about the vulnerability, because you need to find safe spaces to do that, of the business model with people. So you can go to corporate people and stress test, because they can either challenge or strengthen. Because remember, you are still being driven by the key principles, but don't be afraid, the vulnerabilities of the business model to be able to share it with people that are around you as well. That's what I'm saying. Don't. The mental burden is a huge factor in the work that we do, and let's try to work in a way that's the point of community of support, in order to be able to manage this journey. Thanks, Lucas.
100%.
Sorry.
Of course, no problem. No problem. You're more than welcome. Sorry. My phone sometimes just keeps ringing in these mornings. Yes, I think that actually is a great ending point as well to say that, look, the some of the principles in the social solidarity economy have to do with collaborating with people, working together and having a sense of community that supports what you're doing and being willing to reach out and connect, collaborate, partner up. And so it is important to also, take into consideration that it is a safe space and do your best to utilize the safe spaces and try to be vulnerable in sharing these business models that you may feel like, oh, this is too complex. We are here as a co-thinking partner. Intax did mention the importance of mentorship in the space. And so, yeah, take it up upon yourself to use the various channels and the various support systems to push you forward. Because sometimes all you need is inspiration and a community that is behind you to be able to wake up and keep doing the work that is very important, not only for your own personal livelihood, but for the livelihoods of the communities and the economies in which we operate in. So yeah, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much again for joining us for the session. Thanks again to Intax and Dumi for hosting and facilitating this very engaging and very important conversation from us at Oribi. And Inclusion Studios will share with you guys the link to Dumi's work. We'll see you again next week, Monday, for our last peer-to-peer session. But with for this round of Food for Thought open webinars, this will round it up for Bridging the Gaps. We will come back to you in the next quarter with more engaging food for thought topics that encapsulate some of the work that is important when operating in the food systems. So, yeah, cheers, folks. We'll see you again next time.